What a normal life is like for the rest of the world does not apply in Gaza. It almost never has. At the height of its glory 20 years ago, Gaza had an airport. But that only lasted for 3 short years before the airport was decimated by Israel in 2002. Since then, with war after war, life only got tougher. Even before October 7, the lights in Gaza only came on for an average of 4 to 6 hours a day. Now, thousands are trying to survive without electricity or even internet. Before October 7, nearly 98% of Gaza's water was undrinkable. Now, Gazans have less than half of the minimum water requirements for survival. Nearly everyone is thirsty. Gaza now needs 500 to 600 trucks of aid a day, but at its highest, a few days ago, only 300 or so were allowed in, meeting only a fraction of Gaza's needs. And it just gets worse. Gaza currently has not a single fully functioning hospital. Education has been completely put on hold since October 7, and experts believe that much of the population that hasn't been killed will not be able to go back to school or university because they're needed by their family to make money after everything they had was destroyed. The World Bank estimates that the cost of damage between October and January alone is nearly $19 billion. In Gaza, where almost 70% of homes have turned to rubble. This is all aside from the fact that more than 34,000 people have been killed by Israel's war there, lives that have been lost forever. Can life in Gaza ever really go back to normal? This is Beyond the Headlines, and I'm your host, Nada Altaher. This week, we're looking at the path to rebuilding Gaza and the mammoth task at hand. Previous reconstruction efforts in Gaza have always been challenging. Let's look at 2014. After that conflict, donors who had pledged money didn't all actually pay up, and Israel continued restrictions on essential building materials needed for things like sewage infrastructure, desalination plants, and of course, homes. But this time around, the complications are even higher. Even if the war ended now, reconstructing Gaza isn't a matter of removing rubble and rebuilding. The political landscape is complicated enough, even without considering the logistical challenges of simply burying all the dead whose bodies are left in pieces under destroyed buildings, or even removing all those stones, or the extreme pollution left behind by human waste that's been left untreated now for 6 months, or even the effect of the use of such heavy weapons for such a long time on the most crowded place on Earth, or even on people's health, of course, breathing, and the food and water they consume. Joining me now is Rami Al-Azzeh, economist with the Assistance to the Palestinian People Unit at UNCTAD on Gaza reconstruction. Rami, what will it take to rebuild Gaza? And how can international organizations like UNCTAD contribute to Gaza's reconstruction?
So all international organizations have different roles to play in the reconstruction of Gaza. And all these efforts need to be consorted into one comprehensive plan for the reconstruction in Gaza. There is a lot that is needed in Gaza now, starting from first for the international community through the UN Security Council to stop the war. That's the first and second and third requirement to start with. And then to lead the reconstruction efforts for Gaza.
How can UNCTAD actually work with the international community to make sure that reconstruction efforts are going smoothly?
So the latest estimates of the damage in Gaza or the recovery needs in Gaza is the World Bank and UN country team in the occupied Palestinian territories estimates of 18.5 billion in damages in Gaza throughout the first 4 months of the war until the end of January. And when we talk about damages, it does not include the recovery needs for Gaza. So the 18.5 billion is just the damages in the infrastructure and the buildings in Gaza. According to UN satellite UNITAR, in March, they issued a damage assessment in Gaza until the end of February. And it states that almost 88,800 structures in Gaza were damaged or fully destroyed, which is equivalent to 35% of the structures in Gaza, in the whole of Gaza. Now, the level of damages that we've seen in Gaza is unprecedented in terms of the scope and in terms of the intensity. And most importantly, when we look at the damage, we look at the civilian infrastructure. It's not only that building and or houses were destroyed. It's also the health system, the hospitals, it's the schools, it's the roads, it's the water networks, it's the electricity. So every aspect of the infrastructure needed for people in Gaza for their daily needs, it's actually either destroyed or damaged severely. So that's one of the aspects that we look at. Also looking at the internally displaced people that left their houses in the north of Gaza and Gaza City and Deir el-Balah, Khan Yunis, the majority of the people in Gaza are now crowded in Rafah in the south. Huge task of rebuilding or the reconstruction in Gaza is really a huge task. And that's if the war actually ends now.
How can we make sure that the funds and reconstruction materials actually enter Gaza? And how important is it that the Palestinian government plays a role in all of this?
So I think UNCTAD's message in their assessment in January was that the set of requirements needed for Gaza reconstruction or after the end of the war. And it starts by that this needs to be part of a political solution. It cannot just be just a plan, because we've seen in Gaza in the past 17 years, it's a vicious circle of destruction and inadequate reconstruction. The blockade remained, the slow reconstruction, the fatigue of donors to keep refunding or funding the reconstruction in Gaza after every military operation. It is very important that we see a political context which enables the reconstruction. And it starts by lifting the blockade and the restrictions in Gaza, reintegrating Gaza and the West Bank under one entity, one government, strengthening the institutions which can lead this reconstruction efforts in Gaza. And most importantly, donors and the international community should engage heavily in the reconstruction of Gaza, because what we've seen in terms of destruction and needs is unprecedented.
How far back economically has the war set Gaza?
I'm just going to give you a bit of context. Just before the October 2023, Gaza was under blockade. It went through 6 military operations, Israeli military operations. And in the between 2007 and 2022, the Gaza's economy grew by 1%. It had the worst economic performance in the world. It has the highest unemployment in the world, 45%. That's the people who actually still did not lose hope in finding a job, and they remained in the labor market looking for a job. 2 out of 3 people in Gaza, 2/3 of the people in Gaza, are under the poverty line. The infrastructure in terms of electricity, water, clean water access was all at minimal in Gaza. That's prior to October 2023. Now, when we look at the last quarter of 2023, since the war started, Gaza lost 80% of its GDP in one quarter. So for Gaza, and our UNCTAD calculation is that Gaza, if in the best case scenario, grew by 10%, it will take until 2035 to go back to its 2006 levels of GDP per capita. It will take until 2037 to go back to its 1994 GDP per capita. But this is basically a very optimistic scenario that Gaza can grow by 10% annually and consistently for the next 12 years. And that was only until the end of 2023.
And that is assuming that the war ends immediately and the economy starts to boom, 10% growth rate, and everything is allowed to go in. Political climate is perfect. Everyone is working on reconstruction, yeah, which is none of which are true.
Yeah, and when we have the pessimistic scenario, which is Gaza goes over the, we go back to what it was after the 2014 war, for example, where the reconstruction is limited to what the Israeli authorities let into Gaza in terms of reconstruction materials, and that the blockade is still there, the risk of military operations every few years is still there. And the economic performance of Gaza was severe in the sense that Gaza on average grew by 0.4% annually. And this will take us for 2092, or at least 70 years or seven decades for Gaza just to go back to where it was in 2022.
You touched upon this in your last answer, Rami. How much more severe is this round of reconstruction compared to the one in 2014? And can reconstruction in Gaza actually begin this year? Or does it require a lot of international coming together and agreement?
I think the best comparison is to see the level of damages. So until February 2024, the level of destruction we've seen in Gaza, according to UN satellite or UNOSTAT, is basically four times the destruction we've seen after the 2014 51 days of military operation. So in that sense, the needs are actually much, much higher. Also, because in 2014, the civilian infrastructure, hospitals, schools, water, road, all of this was not affected as much as it was affected in this kind of military operation. And that's why we said that we cannot go back to the status quo prior to October, because it won't work given the level of destruction. And the economic performance in Gaza, given the blockade and the political context and the recurrent military operations, deemed it there was no way for Gaza to be fully recovered or reconstructed after the 2014 war, which was way less severe than what we're seeing now. And even with the engagement of donors, given that the blockade was still there in terms of logistics and letting the construction material into Gaza, it was still, after almost a decade, still not fully reconstructed after that war. So the comparison, I think, the main takeaway from this comparison is that there is no way that the level or the efforts that were after the 2014 war, the context that was after the 2014 war, the blockade, the political context, the international community's engagement can actually work in any way after the current military operation, given how severe it is.
One of the most complex projects that Gaza needs right now, more than ever, are desalination plants. And even before the war, not all of Gaza's desalination plants were even fully functioning. Before October 7, most of the water was undrinkable in Gaza. Agricultural land, the food that grows from it, and the water that it needs to grow are all going to be impacted from the heavy use of weapons for more than 6 months. I am joined now by Amira Akker, a postdoctoral fellow at Canada's Université Laval, who specializes in epidemiology and environmental health, to look closer at this. Amira, you've told me in a previous interview that nearly 98% of Gaza's water was deemed undrinkable before the war. Can you explain why that was the case back then?
So first, thank you so much for having me on to discuss this really important topic. So with regards to the water situation in Gaza, there are a number of different reasons as to why the current coastal aquifer is deemed undrinkable. And for one thing, there is just the simple problem of overextraction. Right now, the coastal aquifer is the main source of water in Gaza, and there is an overextraction within Gaza itself. But you also have to keep in mind that there's also been a lot of water theft by Israel. So some reports have even said that up to 80% of the water within Palestine, but even within Gaza, has actually been stolen by Israel. So you have that one problem of overextraction, be it through Israel, but then the overdependence of the aquifer within Gaza itself. You also have sea intrusion that is polluting the groundwater. And then you also have the problem of sewage. Because there is a constant problem of Israel blocking fuel to the Gaza Strip, what you end up finding is that a lot of these sewage and treatment plants have to dump a lot of the sewage out into the Mediterranean Sea, and this ends up polluting the aquifer again. So you have the overextraction, you have the seawater intrusion, and then you also have contamination of the sewage back into the aquifer.
This is directly related to what you just told us. Tell us more about the challenges faced by the desalination plants that existed before the war on October 7, and how previous wars have even impacted the desalination plants' functionality and the domino effect of all of this.
So One thing to point out is that while desalination plants in Gaza are an important source of drinking water within Gaza, they also only account for approximately 15% of drinking water in Gaza. This is pre the current events, of course. It's still the major problem is really around the aquifer. But be it for the desalination plants or the pumping of the water out of the aquifers to the actual sewage problem, it all comes down to the military blockade. And the fact that this illegal military blockade that has been going on for 17 years has completely limited infrastructure supplies and electricity and fuel in order to efficiently run all of these different programs, propagate all of the current issues that exist in Gaza. So it all comes back to that military blockade.
Can you talk to us a little bit about the long-lasting impacts on Gaza's future in terms of water and food security and agriculture on this protracted war that's been using an immense amount of weapons every single day?
So there are going to be a lot of issues once we can get past where we are today and start talking about reconstruction. So since we're talking about water, so first start with water. Right now, the water is most likely even more contaminated because of the excess sewage that is being dumped into the Mediterranean Sea even before the current events and the current offensive by Israel. There was also a lot of destruction to the water infrastructure as it stands, which means that the linking of drinking water supplies, be it from a plant, be it a desalination plant, or just turning the tap on to individuals in the remaining homes that stand, is also going to be a major undertaking to fix. There's also going to be the problem of contamination of the water from the use of weapons. So things like heavy metals, even white phosphorus. So white phosphorus can last for thousands of years in areas that have no oxygen. So that's in the bottom of waters or in deep soil sediments if it can seep down all the way down. So we're going to have contamination of the groundwater from the heavy metals and from things like white phosphorus. That is also going to be a major problem moving forward. We're also going to have major problems with food. So just since October, approximately 40% of all agricultural lands have been destroyed by Israel. And we're talking about 2,000 sites, farm sites, that were completely uprooted. This is farms and orchards. We also have greenhouses that were completely destroyed. So approximately 90% of greenhouses in northern Gaza were completely destroyed. And then approximately 30% of greenhouses around Khan Yunis alone were destroyed. So even in terms of food security alone, this is going to be a major impact. Because even though Gaza had a pretty modest agricultural output, it was enough to sustain the Gaza population. This is now going to have to be rebuilt all over again. And this is going to make Gaza even more dependent on outsourcing their food needs. And this, of course, is also going to add to the issues of a famine moving forward. Even if we were to end everything today, and food were to start coming into Gaza right now, in terms of its long-term impact, food is still going to remain an issue because so much of the farmlands have been destroyed. This is also going to be related, obviously, to the water issue. Because so much of the water is considered brackish and unfit for human consumption without proper cleaning, we're now going to need even more water in order to fix the food problem that we currently have.
Can you talk to us a little bit about how realistic it is to extract the chemicals from the agricultural land or the food or the water, and how difficult or complicated it's going to be to rebuild Gaza when the stones and the rubble themselves are intertwined with human remains?
I think this is probably the most difficult part of thinking about the reconstruction of Gaza. The fact that there are so many people that have been stuck under the rubble. And how do you first deal with that from a practical perspective, but I think much more importantly, how do you honor these lives when you're thinking about reconstruction? And this may not directly answer your question, but I really think that this is an important part. I was trying to learn more about what cities have done in the past to reconstruct after war and after conflict. And the one thing that I've noticed was the majority of cities that I read about is that most of the successful reconstruction programs or projects that occurred usually started with community-initiated cultural restoration. And what that meant was having projects that really spoke to honoring the lives that were lost. And even though I think a lot of us, especially those of us who are on the outside, even if we are Palestinian, we're still outside of what's currently occurring. I think we're thinking about it in very practical terms, in terms of, okay, what are we going to do with the debris? What are we going to do with the chemicals? What are we going to do with the water? What are we going to do with the sewage? Which are all excellent questions. But I think there's a deeper part to it. And it's about the cultural reconstruction of Gaza and restoring the importance of the city itself and of the land itself to the people.
We've reported extensively about what it will take to rebuild Gaza. And as the war continues to go on and have unbelievably devastating and long-lasting impacts on what's left of the population, we will continue to explore what this all means here at The National. That's it for today. Please remember to subscribe to get all the new episodes of Beyond the Headlines as soon as they come out. This episode was produced by Arthur Edison and Da'at Farid, and I'm your host, Nadal Tahir.